Extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and this week I'm joined by Chris Hamill. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm okay, mate. We just had this chat, didn't we, off camera. Mixed bag for me this weekend. Of course, finish with Celtic losing to Ross County. A historic loss. I don't think we've lost to them in the league for over a decade. So, yeah, poor end to an otherwise okay weekend.
I mean, at this point, is it not just like assumed that you're going to break all these records? Who was the other team you lost to that you'd like never lost to at home or something recently?
No, this is the second time we've lost to Ross County this season. yeah, in a cup as well, which was pretty poor. If memory serves me correctly, anyway. But yeah, there is an inevitable disappointment with most weekends when it comes to Celtic at the moment. But it goes back to what you kind of said to me off camera as well, right? That you didn't mind watching Arsenal lose to Manchester City because there were clear signs of progress, or at least individuals to get excited about.
Yeah.
Whereas with Celtic at the moment, we have talk of like Neil Lennon keeps insisting he's a manager, the right manager for a rebuild job. And we are, you know, on the cusp of an exodus with all our best players who we've simultaneously, you know, allowed to enter the final years of their contract at the same time. So there's not even hope on the horizon for me at the minute, Van Straten.
Well, at least you're in good company, though, because today we are going to talk about some of the bigger sides, and particularly the champions around Europe, who had a really, really bad weekend. Obviously, Liverpool lost, PSG lost, Bayern lost. In Spain, okay, the champions didn't lose, but the runaway favourites for the title, Atleti, lost. But before we get into all of those, I think we're going to stop in Italy. And look, we've been covering Italy kind of a lot this season, but it genuinely is one of the most exciting leagues in Europe right now. And it was a huge match this weekend. Probably the first time in ages that the cat has decided to join me on the table. But it was the first time in ages that the Milan derby was actually relevant for the title race. Now I have to let the cat out. Bye. Bye. Sushi, get out. Sushi, go.
This is primo content.
Good times. Yeah, this is why they pay me very small bucks. So it was really the first time that this was kind of a relevant match, I guess, since maybe the mid-2000s, like the kind of post-Calciopoli days. And it was also a little bit spicy because, of course, the previous time these two sides met, we had that, let's say difficult interaction between Lukaku and Ibrahimovic. Yeah, I think we're being extremely politic there. But in this game, I mean, Inter just ran away with it, didn't they, Chris?
Yeah, like you said, a lot riding on this tie. And I watched the boys talk about it very eloquently on Continental Club. And I think they all agreed that it was going to be quite a fraught one, quite a closely fought encounter. But that's not how it panned out. And AC Milan are now, you know, they've gone from imperious and looking like clear favourites for the Scudetto to putting in some very suspect performances of late. I mean, maybe that tie against Inter in the Cup where, you know, you referenced it before, where Zlatan and Romelu Lukaku went head-to-head. Maybe that was still fresh in the memory. But also, I think a narrow victory over Bologna after that. Pretty emphatic victory against Crotone. But that loss to Spezia has really taken momentum out of their season, hasn't it? Sort of in the new year. And then, of course, not a great result in the Europa League as well. So I expected Inter to really, you know, be the one on the front foot in this tie. And it was really a case of Lautaro Martinez and Romelu Lukaku running riot, wasn't it? They were the standout players in this fixture. And Romelu Lukaku in particular, I thought that was going to be a great matchup against Teo Hernandez, because Teo Hernandez also physically imposing, also a strong runner. But yeah, Romelu Lukaku just ran riot down that right-hand side, cutting back, lovely assist for Martinez's first goal. Martinez showing those predatory instincts that, you know, we were talking about on Scout Report, that we're talking about Sunday Vibes, as to why he might be a really good replacement for Sergio Aguero at Manchester City. And eventually, yeah, that back four, I mean, the centre-back pair of Kier and Romagnoli have been really impressive all season, but they were just destroyed, weren't they? They were turned to dust. And I thought Perisic, two assists for him. It's very rare that he outshines Hakimi on the other wing, but he was also pretty impressive here, mate. But Handanovic had to make a couple of good saves, right?
Yeah, Handanovic, it's one of those things where I think when you watch the highlights, you sort of think, wow, like Milan were really like putting on the pressure, because you see Handanovic make so many great saves. But I think those were really good attempts from quite difficult situations for Milan. Like, I mean, Ibrahimovic had 5 shots in this match. And overall, I think Milan had 15 shots to Inter 16. But when you look at XG, it has Inter at 2.96 and Milan at 0.71. So I think that they were catching their shots quite sweetly, but there was nothing there where really you thought, my God, like Milan should be scoring this. And they just couldn't live with Inter's counterattack. I mean, Inter's counterattack is difficult at the best of times. They are the top scoring side in Italy now. They've got 57 goals in 23 games, which is kind of insane, you know, for a Conte side and a side in Italy. But they just ripped through them whenever they really wanted to. I mean, Lukaku's ball to Martinez for his first goal is out of this world. But the second goal is the one that really concerns me. You know, the third is a counter-attacking goal. Lukaku puts in an amazing finish. The first goal whips the ball into the box. It's just a perfect ball. Martinez gets between two defenders. But the second goal is one where it seemed like there was an absolute defensive breakdown. And I didn't know where the structure had gone. I didn't know who was meant to be marking whom. And it just that did concern me a little bit. But to be honest, this is kind of what we've said all along, which is this is amazing from Milan. You know, they're having a great season. They should enjoy it. We're not convinced that they have the depth to last the distance. And Inter just seem like they do. And I think that, kind of like you said there, you know, the cream is gradually rising to the top. Like, Inter have the best attack in Italy. They have the second best defense. I think their goal difference is like 11 better than anybody else in the league. Like, this to me is a really top quality side. And what I really wanted to ask you is, in your opinion, is Lukaku the best player in Italy right now? Should he be winning player of the season in Serie A, or does it just come down to who wins the title?
Woof. That's a good question, because obviously I think they'd struggle to even give it Ronaldo, you know, out of ceremony. Do you know what I mean? Just because he's been the top goal scorer on the winning side, because Juventus aren't going to claim their 10th Scudetto in a row, are they? I think it probably has to. Trying to think of some other candidates. Like, it's been Ilicic in the past, it's been Papu Gomez in the past. You know, Napoli and Atalanta have kind of been underperformers where maybe individuals have shined but not got the credit they deserve. I think Romelu Lukaku is the outstanding candidate at the moment. Zlatan Ibrahimovic's goal scoring has dried up a little bit of late, hasn't it? I think he was scoring at a rate of like every 69 minutes a couple of weeks ago, which is wholly unsustainable and probably won't finish the campaign as strong as Romelu Lukaku as the minutes begin to show on him. But I think just Lukaku's all-round game deserves recognition, because I don't think anyone's underestimated him as a brilliant goal scorer. I think that was quickly dispelled at West Brom when he put up like 1 in 2. Mm-hmm. Everton pretty solid. Man United, despite having that down second season where he only got 12 league goals, no assists, pretty good again. But this season, his all round game has been a level up, man. And I mean, just to bring it back to this 90, like, he laid on 3 key passes. I think I was level with Perisic, who got 2 assists, but that's more than really creative midfielders like Brozovic, like Eriksen. Like, he's not only just there to finish chances off now, he struck up a truly great partnership with Martinez, and he could quite easily be in double digits for both metrics come the end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see it. And I do think he has been the best player. Like, he's currently the top scorer, though obviously he's played a couple more games, or rather Inter have played a couple more games than Juve. I think Lukaku's only played about 100 minutes more than Ronaldo. I suppose you'd have to count Henrik Mkhitaryan in there. He's got 9 goals and 8 assists in the league now. That's pretty insane. Also, I mean, he's not going to get it because Atalanta are kind of having a weird season and he hasn't played enough minutes. But I was looking at Luis Muriel's numbers. He's got he's got 14 goals and 4 assists. He's played 750 minutes. 14 goals and 4 assists. It's absolutely nuts. I mean, The problem with Milan is they have had some bad results lately, like 3 losses in 5. That is troubling. They've got Roma up next. That'll be an interesting one. That'll show what's really going on with them, I think. But 9 points separate Milan in second from Napoli in seventh. And, you know, you could easily lose your handle on a Champions League spot if you're not careful. So I mean, are we both saying that we think Inter are going to go on to win the title?
Yeah, what are they, 4 points clear at the moment, having both played 23 games? I was trying to actually think of other candidates there as well. I mean, Lazio's form has stabilised, hasn't it? I think they're currently above Juventus, and Ciro Mobile's got 17 goal contributions. So maybe if he finishes strongly and they sneak in the Champions League places, like, he'll be deserving of some credit. But yeah, I think Inter for the title. And if that happens, like, how can you look beyond Romelu Lukaku?
Yeah, I'm still rooting for Juve not to make the Champions League. I just think it would be so amazing.
What is it at the minute? They're sixth, right?
Yeah, but they have got two games in hand on everyone around them. So if they win those two games, I think they go up to a point behind Milan. They'd be in third on 48 points, 5 points off top. So I mean, it's still pretty bunched up. But there are these seven sides, and then there's, I think, like an 8 point gap or something, or a 5 point gap down to the team below that.
Yeah. Sassuolo and Verona and the likes, right?
Yeah, there's only so far those guys are going to go. But I don't know. It's been an interesting one. Should we move on to some other action from around Europe then?
Because let's do it, man.
It was a weekend of big results. So what I want us to do is kind of combine a little whip round Europe with some Champions League preview stuff here. So. Sure. Would you like to start in Spain, Germany, or France?
Spain.
Okay. So we're going to start with Atletico Madrid then.
Yes, pain for Atletico Madrid in Spain. They lost to Levante, didn't they, this weekend?
Yeah, it was 2-0. They lost 2-0 to Levante. XG had it at 2.06 to Atleti to 0.77 for Levante. But the goals...
A classic, then.
The goals Atleti conceded were absolutely hilarious. So the first one, I mean, like, okay, so like in like the eighth minute, I think Morales, who's like, you know, Levante's one guy up front, Morales runs through and puts a pretty good chance wide. I mean, like, you know, it's a good counter-attacking chance. Misses that one. Then a few minutes later, he bangs a shot that hits one defender, hits another defender, and goes in. And then they just managed to hold on to this for the rest of the game, despite Atleti really piling on the pressure. I think Atleti had 28 shots in this game.
Yeah, which is for a normal team, that's like, for a traditionally dominant side, that's probably like 58.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely insane for them to have 11 shots on target. Levante had 6 and 2. But then the second goal came in, like, I think it was like the 94th minute. Oblak goes up for a corner, I want to say, an Atleti corner. It gets headed away, and De Frutos is running away. The guy chasing him down is Oblak. Oblak is trying to make a tackle, and De Frutos bangs it in from right by the sideline on the halfway line to make it 2-0. It was absolutely amazing. But the interesting thing to me about this game is Suarez played 90 minutes. Lodi played 90 minutes. Hermoso, Koke, Felix, like, all these guys played 90 minutes. How does that set Atleti up for the game against Chelsea in the Champions League? And do you think that Chelsea will be a little bit more encouraged? Or what can they expect? Is there anything in this game that tips you off about how Atleti are going to play against Chelsea, do you think?
Yeah, I'd be lying if I said I watched anything but the highlights in this tie. Like, it looked like it had an Atletico sort of victory written all over it, didn't it? And that they would slowly recover from some... you know, pretty inconsistent form in the last five fixtures, let's say. I mean, because they're amazing before that. But I mean, I was surprised that they went with three centre-backs in this. I know that they've kind of been playing with the 3-4-2-1, haven't they, quite a lot. But I thought that, yeah, players like Dembele, Lamar, maybe even Luca Torreira would get more of a run out in this fixture. But yeah, fair play to Paco Lopez's side, because they stayed in the game. And I think... of the 28 shots, like, I can't... in the highlights, I think... how many were on target? I've got 11 down there. 11. 13 off target. Not emphatic, but... how does that inform the game for Chelsea? It's a good question. Like, I imagine, you know, we might see an earlier introduction of Dembele for Suarez, which would be quite exciting. Like, if Suarez lasts 90 minutes twice in a week, I'd be very surprised. Jeffrey Kondogbia, like, he's been in and out of the side. Obviously, he committed an error, didn't he, in this game? So I imagine that might cost him an extended run in the team. And Marcus Llorente has been great as an attacking midfielder, but set up on the right-hand side here, didn't he? So it felt quite higgledy-piggledy this game, which is, you know, class analysis. But I think maybe if we look at it, a shoe on the other foot, like Atletico might take great encouragement from the Southampton game and how sort of Southampton quelled Chelsea in that regard. I mean, Chelsea, I think under Tuchel so far from the three or four games I've watched have been tidy in possession while kind of still struggling to probe effectively, right? Despite, you know, I like it that Marcos Alonso comes inside, Timo Werner works the outside, and then Werner becomes a little bit more of a creator, smashing those like first-time balls across the box. But Diego Simeone is going to be absolutely, you know, extremely happy to let them have that sort of possession outside his third. I think it's just a really interesting matchup, like a Chelsea attack still trying to find its feet, and yes, an Atletico defence that has been suspect maybe in recent weeks, but it was impregnable up until then, wasn't it? So I think I'm going to go 1-0 Atletico, you know. What about you?
That's interesting because, I don't really know what to make of it, because Chelsea, I think, have been quite dull in attack so far because they're still learning, you know, Tuchel's quite complicated positional play, which is probably why in a game like this, I'd play someone like Hudson-Odoi and someone like Pulisic if they're totally fit. Because those are the guys who are capable of just like blowing up a defence with a couple of dribbles. Like, I think that this sort of attack you want to have against Atletico Madrid is the one where you get defenders isolated against your attackers and try and break through that way. I think it's really hard to pass through Atletico. So in that sense, I would be inclined to play those guys who are more unpredictable, capable of just producing something out of nothing. Because otherwise, I think they're just going to hold their shape and just mark all the runners all day. I mean, they pressed really, really hard in this game. Like, we've talked about passes per defensive action before. So that's like how many passes you let the opponent make before you attempt a tackle or a foul. And in this game, Atleti's was around 8, which is pretty strong. It means they pressed pretty hard.
Yeah,
and in that sense, they are quite similar to Southampton. So they might have some, they might see some joy there. But on the other hand, like Chelsea, I still think that Chelsea actually really have an advantage of that year where they played under Sarri. Like, I do think that year under Sarri got them to the point where they just play, they almost never panic on the ball. They just play really calmly around a press.
What makes you say that? What's the defining factor?
I think that they just have automatic patterns that they go to. Like when you give the ball to someone like Jorginho in midfield, he doesn't even need to look to know where he will have a passing option. And that to me is like a hallmark of the Sarri system. Like, there are still guys in there who I don't necessarily trust on the ball. Obviously, I don't really trust either of the keepers on the ball. I still think people like Zouma can be a little bit shaky. But it just seems to me that when a guy gets the ball deep in midfield, he knows exactly where someone's going to be. And particularly when they start facing pressure, quite often you see someone like Kovacic who then like runs beyond the guys pressing Mount or Jorginho or whoever it might be. And he receives a pass and suddenly Chelsea are running against the back line. These things, I think, are going to happen more and more regularly as time goes on. And I think for the time being, it's quite hard to rob the ball from them in dangerous positions as they develop some slicker movement in the final third. I think that they'll really tear some teams apart. I don't think they're going to tear Atleti apart in this game. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. It's going to be an interesting one because Atleti will press high, and whether they can make their way through, whether Chelsea can make their way through them. I don't know. I'd like to see Atleti do it, I think.
Yeah, I think like a Tuchel system is designed, isn't it, to like punish these sort of sides, I guess, you know, when it sort of transitions to attack and it becomes like a 3-2-5, the fullbacks push up really, really high. You've got this one guy who's the focal point, those two supporting attackers. Like if they can turn Atletico over really quickly and utilize Werner's pace, or, you know, maybe do you think Abraham will start? Will Giroud start?
I have no idea what his preferred attacking lineup is, really.
Yeah, it's really hard to maintain pace with Chelsea at the moment, isn't it? And just in terms of predicting their side. But, you know, Mason Mount, a lot of energy, a lot of defensive pressures. That back four, or whatever he plays, back three, back four, aren't going to aren't going to have it easy, are they? So yeah, it's going to be interesting, but I think close.
Yeah, this one feels like one of the tighter ones, whereas some of the... I mean, should we move on to another one, which I think is going to be fairly straightforward? Though that said, Bayern did lose this weekend. So Bayern lost to Eintracht Frankfurt, who are in absolutely storming form at the moment. I mean, I think they've got 9 wins and a draw in their last 10. They've obviously
like West Ham, right, in the Bundesliga.
Yeah, but I feel like it's more... I feel like they've got more top-end talent. I mean, André Silva is... I think he's on 20 goals for the season now. Yunus's goal in this game was absolutely out of this world. I think he completed 7 dribbles in this match. And Kamada is having a great season as well. So Kamada and Yunus got the goals, and obviously Lewandowski got the consolation for Bayern. But it's interesting now because Bayern are actually not as secure at the top of the Bundesliga as they were previously, right?
Yeah, I mean... Just to go touch upon this tie very briefly, I'm always amazed that no one's gone in for Kostic with a little bit more conviction, right? You know, when they had the last Fab Four, and obviously Seb Haller, Jovic, and Rebic departed. Mm-hmm. Like, I've always thought Kostic was just a really underrated creator in that side, and he got an assist in this game, didn't he? Which I was really pleased to see. Actually, Jovic wasn't that particularly good, was it? I don't remember seeing an awful lot of him in like the 10-15 minutes that I tried to put aside to watch this. But yeah, you're right in the at the start of the season, you know, we were saying that Bayern might not be the same like omnipotent dominating side, and then they recovered really well, didn't they? But it's still only what, one loss, one draw in their last 6 games. So it's not totally alarming for them. They've only lost 3 games as well. So it's a little bit like a Man City Liverpool situation, I guess, last season, isn't it? With RB Leipzig and Bayern Munich, in that as soon as they lose, like it presents an opportunity for that other team who are in great form. I mean, Leipzig lost, when did they lose? They've lost one of their last 6 as well. Can't remember who it was against. I think it might have been Mainz. They lost to Mainz, maybe 3-2. But it's 49 and 47 points. And I do think they are the two best teams in the league right now. It feels fairly redundant to say that, but sometimes, you know, Dortmund are underperforming, which has definitely not been the case this season. And the fight for the Champions League places, maybe it'll probably prove to be a bit more interesting than the actual where the title goes. Which is a bold claim, actually, because Leipzig are maintaining pace. But yeah, like Wolfsburg are 3rd. Like, when did that happen?
Yeah, I know, right?
When did they become decent again? Like, what is going on? I think they're unbeaten in the last 6. So the Bundesliga, really fun, really interesting. I hope that gap stays to 2 points. I think RB Leipzig and Bayern have both played 22 games. So it should. And who have they got coming up? I think Bayern have got... that's it. RB Leipzig, Borussia Mönchengladbach is the tasty tie coming up. So, I mean, if they can overcome that and just maintain this sort of pace on a week-to-week basis, let's just see where we are for the run-in. But yeah, impressive that Leipzig have done this with, you know, without Timo Werner. Who's their top goal scorer this season? Is it still Josef Poulsen?
I don't know. It might be Olmo.
I think it's Sabitzer. It's Sabitzer.
God, really?
5. Yeah, so it's been a real kind of team performance from them, hasn't it? Like, they've not... the Sorloth transfer's not necessarily worked out maybe as quickly as they'd like. Still time to grow, I guess. But yeah, it's been a much stronger team dynamic, I guess, rather than relying on the individual brilliance.
Yeah, I'm not that impressed with Bayern, to be honest with you. I don't think Bayern have been the best team in Germany at any stage of the season. And I feel like when people say they have been, it's like people not watching, but just like sort of assuming that Bayern have been the best team. It's kind of like Juve winning the title, you know, the last couple of seasons in Italy. Like, in the early stages of the season, Leipzig and Dortmund were better than Bayern. Like, when you watch them in the stats, like, clearly better. And now, like, Bayern's defence is just all over the place. I mean, obviously, it's easy to say that's weak because they conceded 3 to Bielefeld. They conceded 2 in this game. But they've allowed 31 league goals this season, which is just 1 fewer than they allowed in the entirety of last campaign. Leipzig have conceded 13 goals fewer than Bayern, which is absolutely crazy. And I also think that, you know, the Champions League could make the difference here, because Leipzig, I think we all pretty much think they'll probably go out now of the Champions League. They've obviously got a 2-0 deficit to Liverpool. They lost 2-0, quote-unquote, at home to Liverpool. it's going to be really hard to overturn that. Whereas Bayern, they go up against Lazio this week. And yes, Lazio are in pretty decent form. I think they've won 7 of their last 8. I think they might have beaten Samp at the weekend. But I don't really see the evidence. I don't know, but Bayern are going to win that fixture. And I think then Bayern are going to really, you know, try and push for the Champions League. And I just think that Leipzig have got a good shot. They've got a really good shot.
They have got a good shot. But I still think like Bayern's attack will carry them to the title. They're still taking the most shots in the league. I think the biggest, you're right in that the biggest drop-off has been the defence, because they're conceding nearly 11 shots a game, which is pretty uncharacteristic for Bayern. Like we've historically seen it, you know, well, in the last few years, around like the 8 to 9 mark, haven't we? Very rarely has it crept over 10, which is when you sort of start to get to Europa League territory, I guess. But, I mean, they've conceded 7 goals from set pieces. So there's been some situations where they should have just been, you know, managed better. And I think the signing of Upamecano will probably help that again next season. So at least, you know, they've actually addressed like this like defensive frailty that's creeping in, right? But I still think that, yeah, Lever and Thomas Muller's even, he's double digits for both again, isn't he?
Yeah,
goals and assists. So like I still think they'll power them to the title. Like maybe if Leipzig had Timo Werner still this season, maybe I'd say them. But I'm probably more positive about Bayern sustaining form than Leipzig, unfortunately.
Interesting. Well, the one little bit of foreshadowing there might be that Eintracht Frankfurt beat Bayern this week, and their nickname, the Eagles. They play Lazio midweek in the Champions League. What's Lazio's nickname? The Eagles. So all I'm saying is coincidence, potentially not. Like Bayern Munich could come a cropper. But shall we move on then finally to France? Because, you know, having talked about Frankfurt and Bayern Munich, the natural thing connecting those two, Niko Kovac, who's having a great season with Monaco and a fantastic result of the weekend, right?
Yeah, and I think, well, I don't want to speak for the whole of Euro Football Daily when I say this, but we kind of said that when Bayern were going through a rough patch with Kovac, it was a little bit unfortunate, and it probably wasn't all down to him, right? And an aging defence at the time didn't help. So I think he was probably had his reputation sullied a little bit unfairly after what, a double in his first season? It was the league and the Pokal, right? Bit reminiscent of Carlo Ancelotti, I guess, in that just inexplicably like dropped off halfway through the next campaign. But yeah, the Ligue 1 is looking exciting, and like what an achievement it would be from Christophe Galtier and that young Lille side to win this league title. They're 3 points out in front at the minute over Lyon. Lyon, I think, are playing some of the best football in the league. Probably got, you know, the outstanding player in the league in Memphis Depay, you know, Kylian Mbappe and Neymar aside. Yeah, so I'm happy for Kovac, but I'm also a little bit like eyebrow raised over Pochettino's first, what, 8 to 10 games in the league? Because he's got the lowest points return of any manager in the Qatari regime, right?
Yeah, I think it's not been a tremendous start, but I also feel like he's the only manager in that time who's come in mid-season. And I think that it's, if that Barcelona result was so good that I think it can balance out quite a few bad league results. I was kind of wondering about this because they obviously want the Champions League more than anything else, the ownership of PSG, but they also do see not winning the league as such a humiliation that it will become quite an interesting kind of calculus for Pochettino down the stretch. If say PSG are still in the position they are now, where it's Lille top, then 3 points behind them Lyon, then a point behind them PSG, and a couple of points behind them Monaco, who beat them 2-0 like at the weekend. If they're in that position, but they've got like Liverpool in the Champions League, I think it'll actually be quite difficult for Pochettino to work out where he puts his resources. Like, okay, we've got this really tough tie, so we need to like really commit an effort to beating Liverpool. But on the other hand, if we don't win the Champions League, which, you know, the odds are always against you, and we don't win the league because we put all our resources into the Champions League, it's going to be really, really embarrassing. And I'm going to be in serious trouble after like 6 months in the job.
Yeah.
And I worry a little bit about the effort as well, because, you know, Pochettino sides obviously do press high. We talk about it again and again and again. But PSG have had a lot of injuries this season, and they've got a lot of injury-prone players. Mbappe played the full 90 in this match, having played, obviously, you know, an incredible game against Barcelona in midweek. PSG pressed really, really high. They had a PPDA of 6. I just wonder if at some point, kind of March, April time, the entire team is just going to fall apart because everyone's absolutely knackered.
Yeah, they've got depth, I suppose, but in like weird areas, right? Like in this game, I think it was like Verratti and Danilo Pereira coming on in midfield. So I think Herrera, Paredes and Idrissa Gueye started. And like that's, it's functional. I still think it's really weird that PSG starting fullbacks are Cazorla and Florenzi after this whole period.
I know it's so
but
weird.
Anyway, like yeah, it's odd, isn't it? It's not a team that, this might sound a little bit weird saying, because of how dominant they've been in Ligue 1, but it's not a team that I would expect Pochettino to do great things with from the off, right? I do think there's probably been a sense of realism that's set in terms of like we need to bring in some players and shift some on to maintain like that dominance in the league, you know, that almost took care of itself for a little while. But yeah, I mean, in this game, I think, is it Tchouaméni for Monaco? Like he's 6 midfield. Tackles from midfield. Midfield, De Sassi, Badiashile and Maripán, like a really exciting kind of defensive trio. Not a lot else stood out to me, to be honest, apart from like how old Volland and Ben Yedder are, and they're still doing really well, really functional jobs for Kovac up front. But I don't really have anything really insightful to say about Pochettino at PSG because it's still kind of unfurling.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and of course we don't really know what's going to happen with particularly Mbappe in the summer, because you know at the moment I look at that team and I'm like, I agree with you. I think that if I'm PSG, I go out in the summer and I say, right, let's buy maybe a central midfielder, but definitely let's get 2 top-class fullbacks. Like, that should be our goal. But then I think, well, what if Mbappe goes? Like, I think I still go for fullbacks, but maybe now instead of going for, like, 40, 50 mil players, I go for slightly cheaper guys and put more money into a great forward. Like, I don't know. I think it's quite a difficult one because just... The shape of
unless they get Messi.
Well, unless they get Messi, yeah. But if they keep Messi, they probably keep Mbappe. But I don't know, man. Like I still kind of feel like PSG just should be taking gambles on young fullbacks. Like buy a couple of fullbacks every season for like 15 to 20 mil, and at least one of them will turn into a star. Like that is the kind of thing they should be doing, you know. And we see clubs like, you know, even Barcelona have done it with Sergiño Dest. You know, Bayern Munich have obviously been linked heavily with a lot of young right backs at the moment. Well, if you're PSG, I'm pretty certain Pochettino could go to somebody like Max Aarons, you know, somebody who is highly rated, and say, look, have you seen what I've done with fullbacks in the past? Kieran Trippier. Ever heard of him? Like he wasn't that great, but everyone thought he was amazing under me. Like Ben Davis, I made look like a superstar for a season. Like I think that actually, if you're a fullback, Pochettino is quite a fun manager to go and play under, and that does seem like the next step for them, just going and nailing those positions. And they're hard to recruit for right now, but you can do it. You can at least try. Monaco managed to do it. You know, they've got Inchayo Enrique this season, who's having a great season for them at left back. They've still got Fore Balotore as well. You know, like there are these guys around. And I just think that PSG, over the last couple of seasons, they've shown an ability to think a little bit more outside the box. You know, they haven't gone and just spent a fortune on everybody. They've gone and got Paredes. They got in some weird loans this season. But I actually think that's okay if it enables them to go and spend money on the right fullback. Like last summer, they wanted Hector Bellerin. Okay, well, that's fine. Like, if you think he's the right player for your team, and he'd probably be really good for PSG, go and try and get him. If Hakimi is available from Inter, you absolutely have to try and get him. So I think that that's probably the next move. Because right now, I don't look at them and think this is the best squad in Europe. You know, if they win the Champions League, I think it would be slightly against the odds.
And in this game, I think what was interesting about this game was that maybe like in an obscure turn of events, like Niko Kovac's side looked much more balanced. And like, how is Kevin Volland still 28, by the way? But obviously, like, Sofiane Diop up front, who's only 20.
Yeah, 20.
That's ridiculous. Ben Yedder's still only 30. Like, I think of Ben Yedder and Volland as 32, 33-year-olds, but they're not. But yeah, I think there's just a really nice balance there. And I look at the PSG's bench, and they've got Diallo and Kerrer, who are, you know, good centre-half replacements. I think Kimpembe probably will be one of the best centre-halves, yeah, in the world. But like you said, full-back needs big work. And, like, do they need Herrera and Idrissa Gueye and Paredes playing in the... I like Paredes as a great passer, an underrated passer. But I, whenever Idrissa Gueye and Herrera line up in the same team, I always think, this is boring.
I mean, is it more boring than Marquinhos playing in central midfield last season?
It's true. I think maybe they're saving for the Champions League, right? But or I don't know about his fitness in recent weeks. But
he's always in and out, isn't he?
Yeah, but like I would go for a pretty light start central midfielder as well. Like the dream scenario, maybe if Mbappe goes like you've just said, is that Paul Pogba is willing to go to PSG and just wants out at Manchester United.
Worth. I mean, that would be super fun, but I'm also not sure that's the best use of their money either. Like, I don't really know what
Who
I want.
Who cares about using their money well, though?
Yeah, but I don't really know what I want them to do. Like, I don't even think that's that fun anymore, because I just feel like Pogba has kind of got quite boring. Like, he's just not... I don't know, he's not...
I could see him being unleashed as, like, an 8-come-10 at PSG. Just do whatever you want in, like, the final third of the pitch.
I mean, that would be pretty great. Like, I just want them to be exciting, because I feel like you've got all the money in the world. Like, you should be more entertaining than this. And it's just it is a little bit grindy. Even under Tuchel it was a little bit grindy. But I don't know. I think that probably brings us to the end of our European roundup. But on the topic of grinding, I wanted to talk to you about an interesting app. Anniversary right. That's coming up, right? Because it must be now the 5th anniversary of us starting to work together on FD.
Yeah, I think it's been and gone, right? It was early February.
I didn't remember exactly the date, but I knew it was sometime around here. So like five years and 5 years specifically of you, me and Joe, really.
Yeah, I remember it a little bit more indefinitely because I had to move down from Leicester. So yeah, I think it was early February that I moved, and I would like to say it's, you know, the go-to response is it's happened in a flash, right? But no, I do feel like it's aged me an appropriate amount.
you've been through some physical distress in that time, I would say.
So 5 years, what is, if someone said to you like most prominent memory or standout thing over those 5 years, what's your kind of go-to?
I just,
what do you think of first and foremost?
Oh my God. I still find it really, really hard. Like, just not to say, like, we went to the Camp Nou, saw Messi score a hat trick. That's pretty good. But I mean, there are other things in there as well. Like, even just watching, like, watching the World Cup in the office, I thought was really, really fun. Like, because the Netherlands weren't there. So I was, like, not really invested in any side. But, like, watching England with everyone in the office was genuinely quite exciting. Like, I mean, that was like a really fun thing that happened. I don't know, man. Like
when things were fun, man.
Yeah, I know, right? And like seeing Joe now just being like a regular on TV is pretty amazing. Seeing Zach go from like a child to a sort of man who like has a legit career in football media is like that goes even beyond FD is also pretty amazing. Yeah, and when I joined, I think FD had about 600 EFD had about 600 subscribers on YouTube. It had only just started, and FD had about 600,000. And like, look at us now! Like, it's crazy. Like, whenever I see a video, like occasionally I'll pop into Twitter and I'll just see people like having a conversation. And of course, like, you know, it's a Football Daily video they're talking about. Like, not our ones, obviously. It's one of like Mourinho. But that's still pretty insane, like that level of reach. And of course, you know, we've met people like Thierry Henry. That's pretty good. Had some disagreements with some ex-pros. That's always fun as well. What is it for you? What do you look back on most fondly?
I think you made a good point there in that it's a little bit bizarre how it's kind of become a household name, at least in the UK, I'd imagine, for like online football discourse. And I like that we've kind of cultivated a reputation for like sensible and informed chat. Like I think I could, you know, any one of us could leave at any given point and be pretty proud of the legacy we're leaving, because there is an increasing temptation to kind of cash in that sort of stuff, I guess, for views, because it has become much harder, right? That's the reality. In lockdown, it's become much more difficult. People don't want to watch 40 minutes of lockdown of Zoom calls every day, and that's been really difficult to navigate. I'm really proud of the way that everyone's kind of come through it and been innovative in that time. You know, we've launched Explain, we've launched Football Pyramid, we've launched the podcast channel all in this year. We've got team members like Henry, bless him, who is, you know, was only employed in the office for like 4 to 5 months. So he's kind of worked twice as long at home as he has done for FD in the office, which is a pretty depressing thought. But it's still great to see people grow in that time, you know, become more resilient. But yeah, some more of the fun stuff was like, obviously India was really, really fun. And that was random in that, like, we got to force the agenda with Matt, our former CEO there. It was almost sold to him as like a fact-finding mission, because we very rarely we don't have an operating budget, because, you know, we're a YouTube channel where stuff was able to be, you know, produced in-house by in-house talent, which is great. But yeah, that was a really standout one. Off the beaten track, like, it was almost kind of a bit of a, I suppose, reward in a sense. Interviewing, you know, Dani Alves and sitting in a room with people from The Guardian, the BBC, The Times, and they're like, where are you from? And we're like, Football Daily. And that, you know, they didn't know us, but at the same time, it's just like a little internal giggle. It just alludes to what you were saying, I guess, the company that we were keeping with people that were interviewing. I still think, like, behind the headlines is something I would have liked to open up on a little bit more. I could have liked to have done some more what we coined FD Originals back in, 2019, before, like, early 2019, before kind of it looked like it was going to hit the fan late 2019. So I still think FD has a lot of potential and can produce, you know, can raise the bar even further. But yes, Russia was really fun. Like, that first trip to Barcelona we went on, you're right, that kind of felt like, oh, we're getting somewhere here. We've been invited to, you know, to a legitimate event rather than some kind of like dingy underground, like, grime event where I was like, oh, what am I doing here? But in London. But yeah, it's been a hell of a ride, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a good one. I mean, like, Joe is obviously now like too big for us.
But that's crazy, isn't it? So I was looking at his Twitter, and he was like, "I'm interviewing Pep Guardiola next week." And part of me thinks, like, yeah, that, like, standard, like, that's what Joe does now for a career. But then even to think like that is bizarre. Like, to have that expectancy, I guess. Like, and then the other half of my brain's like, that's crazy. I remember going out to buy newspapers that we were laying over the table to film that first episode of Winners and Losers, or VFN, or ERU.
Yeah.
And it's really satisfying to see the guys, like, that's what Joe wants to do, right? That's what Zach wants to do. Even Kieran, who went on to do what he, like, he wanted to be a YouTuber, he's now a YouTuber. It's great to see people kind of like thrive and achieve an end goal within, or without, in the case of Kieran, FD. Whereas I guess for you, it's a little bit more difficult, like, to see, like, where you're going to transition or take from here, right? Because you're doing a lot of stuff. Like, you've gone back to college, gone back to school. Like, you didn't necessarily want to be a YouTuber, like, or an authority on football. I don't remember you saying that anyway. Like, kind of, I wanted to be a filmmaker. So how do you see it going for you, you know, in the next five, mate?
Well, yeah, like, I mean, it was never something I really set out to do. I did a little bit of writing beforehand, but yeah, I mean, like, when I was at uni, I thought I'd be an academic. Then after uni, I wanted to work in film, and I did for a little bit. And then wrote some stuff about football and kind of ended up on FD. And I mean, I don't... I mean, I've got a lot out of it, but yeah, I think that now I've been thinking about what's next. Like, it's not immediate. Like, I'm doing, like you say, I'm in the middle of a course. I'm training in psychotherapy at the moment. And that's something that, like, I think could potentially be a long-term career for me. But, like, it's, you know, it's still, like, early days. I'm still kind of figuring it out as I go along. So it's an interesting transitional period. You know, when I joined FD, it's been 5 years, so I joined at the end of 2015. So I'd been with Emma then for, like, I don't know, since the beginning of 2014. And now we've been married for nearly 4 years and she's pregnant. Like, I mean, that's quite a significant period of time in my life. Mm. So yeah, it's been tied to
Football Daily. Yeah.
Well, let's not, you know, go overboard. I'd say it was funded by Football Daily. Like, let's put it that way.
So did you have, really simple question, but think we'd get this far, I guess?
What do you mean by we'd get this far? Do you mean like the reach of the channel, or that, you know, we'd all still be here this far on? Or
I suppose you can come at that from any angle you kind of see fit. Kind of all encompassing, right? Like, did you think, yeah, that you'd still be here 5 years on, maybe like 6 months into joining, and that Football Daily would, you know, have been bought by Sky, would have gone from strength to strength, I guess, you know, 2020 excluding, which has been a bit of a weird one for everyone.
No, I didn't. I didn't think that at all. I didn't think it would last as long as this. And there have been times where I've been like, Jesus, like, I thought I'd be somewhere else doing something else by now. But then, like, on the other hand, I'm really glad that Sky came in for FD, because particularly for people like you and Zach and Joe, I think it gives you guys opportunities to do things that you're good at and you're interested in. And so from that point of view, like, I think it's great. Like, I'm absolutely delighted to see the success that, like, so many people on our team have had, like you. And those opportunities would not have been as good, or might not have come along as quickly, had it not been for Sky. Mm. So that's really great. And, like, truly, I mean, like, obviously, like, Joe's obviously, like, a terrible, terrible person. But but I really am so happy for him, like, that he's presenting now, because he's an excellent presenter, and he always has been. And also just the fact that, like, obviously we haven't been on a shoot together for ages, but I remember last year sitting on a Continental Club shoot, like, genuinely a year ago now, and Zach was asked some question out of nowhere about, I don't know, the Bundesliga or something. And he just started, like, reeling off so much information. I was like, he's so well informed about this. And that, to me, has always been the difference between what we do and what a lot of other people do. I'm not saying we're right all the time. We're certainly not. I'm not saying we know what we're talking about all the time. We certainly don't. But the fact that Zach could just be, like, tossed a question about something he hadn't had a chance to prepare for, and he immediately had, like, a lot of interesting, intelligent things to say about it, I was like, That is pretty amazing. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's really satisfying to see, like, the I suppose, kind of people, sounds a bit wild, but people to, like personify the brand, then, I'm gonna say. Like, it's not built on, like, salt and sand. Like, Football Daily, we only get out, like, this much content because the whole team are like, genuinely care, and they're genuinely that well informed. Like, they will make it, they're not, I can safely say, in any given bit of content, no one is trying to fob the audience off. Like, they would have made sure that their opinion carries a certain amount of, like, is well-informed and carries a certain amount of weight, I guess. But, you know, to see, what, for example, like, McCubbin write a great explained on Everton, right? Like, it's just, like, quality assured, I guess, is what I'm trying to say in a little bit of a bumbly manner. It comes with like that seal, that quality. So I think that the whole team deserves a lot of credit for that, because there's always been, like, they've held each other to a high standard.
Yeah.
And the kind of culture fuels itself now, which is great.
Well, on the topic of everything that the team does, is there anything you'd like to point to before we say goodbye?
Oh, okay. What shall I pick? I mean, yeah, go and check out the latest one-on-one. I'm going to shamelessly plug something that I've done just because that sprang first to mind. Any Explained. I think that's some of the best football content that I've watched throughout lockdown. And yeah, just maybe go back and watch some of the podcasts in recent weeks. So on this podcast, we seem to have built a really devout following of about 40,000 people. Be nice to make it 50,000. So I want each one of you at home to tell a friend about this podcast.
Is that a thing that we can enforce? Tell a friend, yes, about this podcast or you're banned.
Yeah.
There you go. Straight from Chris Hamill's mouth. Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Chris. Thank you to you guys at home for watching or listening. Make sure that you're subscribed to us either as a video podcast at Football Daily Podcast on YouTube or as an audio podcast if you're just listening to this for the first time. And we really do appreciate your support. So here's to many more years of FD and FD content, like giving you hopefully what you want. Thanks very much, and we'll see you later. Bye.
Bye.